Ladies and gentlemen, welcome inside the After Hours podcast. My name is Brandon Apter. Thank you for joining me. This is the first episode of the After Hours podcast reboot. I appreciate everybody tuning in as I bring this podcast in a new direction, more niche-based towards something that I am very passionate about and worked in for nearly a decade, and that's minor league baseball. Before we get into the guest of the episode, make sure that you're following the After Hours podcast on Twitter at After Hours Pod. Also on Facebook, just type in After Hours Podcast, you'll be able to find there. And the After Hours podcast is available on iTunes, Google Play, and now Spotify. So make sure you subscribe on one of those platforms as well. So anyway, just a quick introduction before we dive into the guest for my episode. For those of you who don't know, I worked in the industry of minor league baseball for 9 years. Started back in 2009 working for the Reading Phillies, now the Reading Fightin' Phils. Did an internship there, did a 9-month assistant position with the Wilmington Blue Rocks, high A affiliate for the Kansas City Royals in 2010. Before moving on and working 3 seasons with the Frederick Keys, high A affiliate of the Baltimore Orioles, as the promotions manager. So what I did there was more or less plan and execute all of the on-field promotions, spearheaded the creation of the team promotional schedule each year, and really had the opportunity to start emceeing in Frederick, which I really enjoyed, the fan interaction and everything like that. So I spent 3 seasons in Frederick before moving on to Gwinnett with the Gwinnett Braves, now the Gwinnett Stripers, who are the AAA affiliate for the Atlanta Braves. So I got to be the marketing and promotions manager for a AAA club for 2 years, and I learned a lot in my time there. Really enjoyed getting to perform on the field at the AAA level. And Gwinnett was also the second team that I got to manage a group of college interns as well, which is a really, really rewarding experience that I enjoyed. Learned a lot about myself, learned a lot about other people, and learned a lot about really my management style moving forward and how I wanted to conduct myself professionally. In my next job, and my next job after the Gwinnett Braves, spent 2 seasons in Port Charlotte, Florida with the Charlotte Stone Crabs, and also worked Tampa Bay Rays spring training as the director of community relations, promotions, and marketing. So that was over a 9-year span from 2009, and my last season in minor league baseball, for the time being, was 2017. Now I'm working at Kennesaw State University in Georgia, but still very, very passionate about minor league baseball. I keep in touch with a lot of the people that I've worked with across the years. And so in thinking about where I wanted to bring the After Hours podcast moving forward, I really enjoyed the 20-ish episodes that I did before, talking everything from Philly sports to catching up with people from my class of 2005 from Upper Dublin High School, to talking to friends I have that also have famous dads, and talking about wrestling. So it just kind of went in every which direction it could possibly go. But I kind of had trouble finding topics to talk about, really. So I figured that it was time to take the After Hours pod in a new direction, and that's what we're doing. Obviously, sports is the overarching passion from my previous batch of episodes, and that'll continue here as we go into the business of minor league baseball. And obviously, you see After Hours, a minor league baseball podcast, and you might be thinking that this is strictly prospects and games and stuff like that, but it's actually not that. We'll have some of that, but it's primarily going to be talking about the business of baseball. And one of the things that's been really sweeping across minor league baseball for the last 5 to 10 years is team rebranding. You see all of the wacky, zany minor league names, from the El Paso Chihuahuas to the Lehigh Valley Iron Pigs, to the Biloxi Shuckers, the Rocket City Trash Pandas, The names go on and on. So rebranding, obviously, there were a lot of teams this offseason, 2018 offseason, that decided to refresh their brand, whether it be their logo or their name completely. So that's really the first topic that we're going to dive into on episode one of the After Hours podcast. I'm lucky enough to be joined by MILB.com's Ben Hill. You'll learn a little bit more about him throughout the episode, but he's more or less minor league baseball's promotional god. He travels around to minor league ballparks. He's now seen every single minor league park that's active after the 2018 season. He obviously has some parks to visit come 2019 with new stadiums and some new teams as well. So we'll learn more about Ben's background, and then we'll talk about the teams that rebranded this offseason. And in future episodes, I'll actually be speaking with some of the teams that decided to refresh their brand over the offseason. So there's a lot of exciting people to talk to, things to learn, and experiences to be had on the new After Hours podcast. This intro has now been going on a little bit more than I had hoped. We're now at 6.5 minutes, so I am going to stop talking. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Oh, and you can follow my guest, Ben Hill, on Twitter, at BensBiz, and you can also check out his minor league baseball journeys at bensbiz.mlblogs.com. That's bensbiz.mlblogs.com. Anyway, without further ado, please enjoy episode one of the newly rebooted, refreshed, rebranded, not really rebranded. Okay, episode one, After Hours Podcast. Here we go. All right, we're back inside the After Hours Podcast, and right now I am joined by Ben Hill of MILB.com. He's been covering the business and culture of minor league baseball since 2005. We've spent probably about the last 10 minutes talking about what title he wants to use, and I decided that one. Ben, thank you for coming on, and welcome to the After Hours podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Of course. We're just going to start off towards the beginning. Obviously, what you do now, traveling around to the minor league baseball ballparks, is well known across minor league baseball, really, by people that work in it, people that follow it. You hear Ben Hill, and you know it's the guy that travels around from team to team and showing all of the unique things going on in minor league baseball. But let's learn a little bit more about you. Tell us a little bit more about your background, where you went to school, and how you kind of started getting into the whole minor league baseball thing.
I could go on forever about that, because well, I guess anyone could about their career path. To try to do it succinctly, I grew up in very close to you. I grew up in Ambler, Pennsylvania. Went to Wissahickon. Your rival, and always a huge baseball fan. Loved to play baseball as a kid. Loved the Phillies as a kid. Yeah. Always loved baseball, but never specifically set out to be a baseball writer. I ended up going to college in University of Pittsburgh. Had a communications degree there. Back then, my focus was more college radio and kind of in the music world, but I graduated, did a year of AmeriCorps, worked in a school, got an opportunity to move to New York, kept doing education jobs for a couple years, finally decided I maybe didn't want to focus on that as my career, was temping all over the place, just having a fairly interesting but also very frustrating and very, no disposable income New York existence.
It's tough to get by like that in New York, that's for sure.
I was struggling. I had many periods in the beginning where I didn't think I was going to make it. And a lot of that because I didn't even know what I was trying to do. I was just kind of flailing around. So, and that's how this started. I got a job in 2005 through a friend. That friend is Zach Hample, who is kind of known in the baseball world as the ball hawk. He has thousands of balls that he's gotten at games.
Oh, yeah.
He got A-Rod's, most notoriously, he got A-Rod's 3,000th hit home run.
Those guys can be pretty vicious, too, when it comes to Not the bigger name ball hawks, but I ran into one in Frederick one time that would legitimately take people out to get those foul balls.
Yeah, and Zach, people talk trash on Zach all the time, and I can't get into that because that's a whole nother discussion. But he is a far different person than a lot of the internet stereotype would suggest. I met him through Craigslist way back in 2003 through
Sounds
the Activity
safe.
Partners. It was safe. It was through the Activity Partners section. I mean, back then, this was like pre-most social media, so I was using Craigslist to kind of set up a lot of aspects of my life in New York.
Oh, true.
I responded to an ad that Zach put up, not knowing who put it up or who he was, but to hit fungos in Central Park. And I was just kind of like, you know what? I miss that. I miss just throwing a baseball around, hitting a baseball around. It turned out to be Zach Campbell. We became friends. Cut to 2005. Through some connection of his own, he had gotten a job writing for MILB.com. Which then was minorleaguebaseball.com, and it was in its very first season.
Yeah.
It's run by MLB Advanced Media, so the job was actually through MLB Advanced Media to write for the minor league website.
And that's when everything was HTML based back then, with the running Jaguar.
Yeah, I believe it was a cheetah. But I had nothing to do with really any of the technical back end stuff back then. We don't do it anymore, but back then, every single game would be written up as a recap.
That's right, yeah.
Most of them without quotes, without anything else, just quick recaps built around box score and play-by-play logs. And I had no experience, but I'd always been a baseball fan, and Zach got a part-time night shift job through whatever connection he had. He called me one day and was like, hey, they need more people. It seems like you could write. You definitely love baseball. And because the site was still new, they just were like, when I called the person that Zach told me to call, he was like, oh, yeah, you're Zach's friend. Cool. And I just like showed up and filled out an application later as an afterthought. That would not be the process today at all.
Yeah. And but just to let you know, on the show, we call that an afterthought because it goes around with the pun side of the show name.
Well, so the next time that comes up,
I should have put that in the disclaimer notice beforehand. That's my bad.
Right. I will use that terminology correctly the next chance I get.
Yeah.
The application was an afterthought, and it would not work that way now. But I think that's like a lot of life. I think everyone has their own equivalent stories of just, sometimes you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, or sometimes you're in the right place at the right time. And at the time, I didn't think anything of it other than, okay, I have this part-time night shift hourly job writing about baseball. And why not? It's just something new. And it'll get me a little bit of cash, and I'll just keep kind of flailing about looking for something that sticks. And I just didn't – it didn't occur to me. I never thought early on in 2005, like, this will be my career that
yeah.
I'll be
– Yeah, I mean, it's – it's definitely evolved since then, going from writing recaps to now what you do. And if you, in a nutshell, I guess, could put into words, I know, again, like we said, we were kind of going back and forth as to what your job title is because there's so much involved with it. But like in a nutshell, what would you say you do now? Like, how has it evolved?
Yeah, well, now it's I call it the business and culture of minor league baseball. Essentially, there's 160 teams, and my beat is how this industry, both as individual entities and collectively operates. And, it's a really interesting world, and I think the average sports fan still doesn't really get it in a lot of ways. That minor league, if you work in a minor league front office, you have no control over the product on the field.
Yeah.
So it's a very strange dynamic, where if you work in the front office of minor league sports, you're basically just concerned about creating a consistent entertainment entity because that's all you can really control. And I didn't know that really going into this job, but the game recaps transitioned the next year to me working during the day just because I didn't want to work at night and the site was still so new. Again, they were just like, okay, you can come in during the day. And then I was just the only writer hanging around during the day. I started getting assigned random stories. I was asked to write a promo column. And it was really just through making jokes and having fun with a promo column, researching the top 10 promos of the week, that was the inkling of this whole niche. Because I started getting feedback from people who worked in baseball being like, this is great. And teams would be getting in contact with me and saying, hey, you might want to include us, because that had never existed before, a real-time sort of log or real-time coverage of what other teams are doing, and other teams always want to know what other teams are doing, because there's no real competition in minor league baseball, because every team in its own market. There's a lot of competition with teams trying to one-up one another, but, you know, they yeah. share ideas. That's the nature of the industry. So I was inadvertently at first providing a service, and that's what kind of created this niche. Started the blog to kind of further expand on what I'd learned through the promo column. It took me like 4 years to finally get full-time. Then once I was full-time, it was like, if I'm now a full-time expert in this world, at that point, I'd only been to a handful of parks, mostly local, PA, New York area, where I grew up or where I was living. And that's how the road trip started, of kind of like, I really need to go to these places to understand who these teams are and why they operate the way they do. And then through the years, and that started in earnest in 2010, through the years, the road trips became a big part of my coverage in and of itself. Exploring America through minor league baseball. So now there's that aspect, the road trip aspect, as well as, the business stuff and the rebrandings and stadium news and everything else. And that's how it came to be, more or less.
Yeah. So obviously you were talking about how the top 10 promo countdowns and everything. And I remember that's when I think I started reaching out to you, when I was working in Frederick 2011, 2012. We were doing some apocalyptic theme nights and everything. And I think it was like the 2011 or 2012 promo seminar where I first met you. And then since then, I had kind of like throughout the teams that I worked for reached out and been like, hey, we're doing this thing cool. So I think speaking from experience after hearing your story, it's always good to have, that kind of like national person that's covering promotions that never was really a thing to kind of pay attention to what you're doing. And at least from my experience with you, and I'm not just saying this because I'm saying it, but it was always nice to have a back and forth. It wasn't like a, hey, like, that's cool. It was always like, tell me more. What are the details? So that was something I always appreciated. So obviously there's a lot of job progression as you talked about. Going to the traveling aspect, I know I'd reach out to you every now and then. You'd be in one state one day and another state another day. You've now visited every ballpark, correct? Every active ballpark, I should say.
Yeah, that was the milestone I hit last year. Of course, now that we're speaking the year 2019, I now technically haven't been to every active ballpark because there's three that will debut in 2019.
Right.
But yes, at the end of last year, I hit the milestone, hashtag been everywhere, where I could finally say I've been to every single park. And so I'm in the process right now of kind of going through the archives so I can really have a sense of like exactly how many ballpark visits I've made. But by the time last season ended, I'd been to all 159 active affiliated parks, 174 minor league parks total, including ones that are now defunct. And I don't know how many total visits, but probably 300 or more since 2010.
Now, obviously, before we started recording, I did some looking up with regard to where you've been recently, where you started, when you started doing these road trips kind of in the early 2010s. Would you say, I know you did kind of like your classification favorite ballparks, but is there one that kind of you go to multiple times that you're always just like, this is the pinnacle, at least like, one of those things where you don't want to throw other teams under the bus? But I've been to a handful of stadiums, and I know whenever I go to Reading, Pennsylvania, that's kind of like baseball town. That is like the perfect atmosphere of what you expect of a minor league baseball game. So if you don't have a favorite, maybe a couple of your favorites. I guess what's ahead for you next now that you've crossed pretty much everyone off your list except for the three?
Yeah, I mean, my favorite ballpark is probably the number one question I get asked at the end of this season after I hit the milestone and finally felt like, okay, now I can definitively say what my favorites are because I can literally compare every single ballpark. I did a whole series of Ben's Best articles, and I broke them up by level so I could kind of deal with that fundamental minor league disconnect where it's really hard to say what the best is when you're dealing with AAA parks, and whatever, Memphis, Las Vegas, Nashville, El Paso, to a rookie ball stadium in, you know, Bluefield, Virginia, or West Virginia, or whatever state that ballpark's in, because like
very different atmospheres and sizes. Right on.
Yeah, and I say I don't know what state the Bluefield's in because like that ballpark is basically on the state line. But anyway, you mentioned Reading. I mean, of course, that I picked that as my favorite Double A, and that has to be way up there. I do feel like I try to remove my fan bias as much as I can.
Of course,
but you know, growing up as a Phillies fan and growing up with Reading, you know, growing up in Ambler, PA, with Reading being about an hour away. I didn't really go to games there much as a kid, but it speaks to me a little bit more as a fan, being their long connection with the Phillies, and it really is a best of both worlds scenario, where you've got a long affiliation, a old ballpark, but one that still has the energy and vitality and a kind of front office operating perspective, you know, to keep it very relevant and new and groundbreaking at the same time. So, you know, I don't like to play straight up favorites because it's so hard to compare, but. Reading is certainly up there for sure.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you have new ballparks to visit, and that kind of leads into the next topic that we're going to talk about. You know, you started visiting ballparks again, like I said, in the early 2010s, probably before that even. But I'm just using that as a benchmark, really. So that being said, you know, obviously back then, a lot of the ballpark experience is based on kind of like the basic on-field stuff that you're doing. At least in like 2010, 2011, there was a lot of like wah-wah hokey tosses up north, you know, relay races and hula hoop type games. And now you fast forward to 2018, 2019, and you have so much more interaction and so much more fan experience in the ballpark. Can you speak a little bit to how the ballpark experience has kind of evolved and changed since you first started?
Yeah, I mean, again, it really varies because there's a lot of ballparks as we head into 2019 that operationally speaking haven't changed, you know, too much. So yeah. I guess what you're really talking about is the fact that we, you know, average maybe about two new ballparks a year, at least in the time I've been covering it. And, you know, the ballpark boom, such as it was or is, you know, goes back to the 90s, early-ish 90s. And so I just think, you know, as each new ballpark comes and replaces an old one, you just see that greater emphasis on, of course, on not really just having a seat and sitting in a seat for 3 hours, but having not just a between inning contest, but the whole ballpark experience being as kind of mobile and interactive as possible with the 360-degree concourses and the things you can do during the game for entertainment, the way teams utilize, you know, technology. You know, last year in Charlotte, I raced a Tyrannosaurus Rex on the ribbon board, you know, across the outfield.
Yeah.
And I was thinking like, wow, you know, like, you know, we've reached a new level here where we now have these interactive between inning games that utilize, you know, these really high def ribbon boards, you know, as part of a between inning contest. So that's going to keep changing. But at the same time, a lot of those contests you mentioned, you know, you can still find them all over the
Build-A-Burger is still in a lot of places.
Yeah, whether it's just because, you know, stick with the classics because they work, or because just because the industry is changing, there's a lot of teams that are still going to be operating in ballparks that were built in, you know, 1974, 1988, or whatever the case may be, where you just because the technology is out there doesn't mean that team has access to it, which is big picture why I love the minors, because there's such a wide range of experience.
Because you get to see all the new stuff. I know recently, like I went to Nashville, which is a relatively new stadium, and that's like gorgeous. Lots of in and outs there, a lot of ballpark features. And then, you know, you go to a place like Asheville and you appreciate like all of the history there. So you're exactly right when it comes to talking about, you know, depending on the ballpark, it's a different atmosphere really, but you can go from historical to like tiki bars in a matter of, you know, a couple of state lines crossing those state lines.
Yeah, absolutely. And that general area you mentioned is one of my favorites, especially the Carolinas.
Yeah.
Yeah, where you can see a Durham Bulls game in a pretty, you know, not a super new stadium, but a stadium that is still kind of classifies as new in terms of its amenities, big AAA team, huge national recognition, then you could go the next day, drive less than an hour, and see a game in the Appalachian League in Burlington.
Yeah.
And I love that contrast for sure. And I don't think it's like one is good and one is bad. I think they both – and that's been my approach as a writer is to, you know, just to celebrate – to, you know, not be positive for – You're getting some texts here.
Yeah, I need to turn that off. Continue.
but just to celebrate whatever is worth celebrating about every team. So I don't want to be positive just, you know, for no reason, but I do try to bring a fundamentally positive approach to my writing and just find what makes each team unique. And that's just kind of how I've always approached it. And, you know, and I take a – I don't want to quite say offense, but – often when I have my itineraries or, you know, people are like, oh, where are you going tomorrow? And I'll say such and such place. And they're like, ugh, you know, good luck with that. I feel like, well, that's not a good attitude. It is what it is. And there's still things there that are going to be worth seeing, people worth talking to. And quite frankly, I like a lot of the older, you know, a little bit more down on their luck places because you get more eccentricities and weirdness. And I'm always on the lookout for that.
Yeah. Was it Kannapolis that has Toast Man?
That's West Virginia Power Toastman, who was the deputy mayor. Rod Blackstone was the deputy mayor of Charleston, West Virginia. But I guess the mayor who for whom he was the deputy, you know, is out of office now. And the team hired the Toastman. So the Toastman is not just a fan who throws toast into the crowd during the game. Now he's actually working for the team.
Yeah. And I think it's definitely worth mentioning too that minor league baseball has grown so much over the years that now you're starting to see a lot of these, you know, on-field contests and stuff kind of roll over to the big leagues too. I know at least where I am in Atlanta, the Atlanta Braves do a pretty good job of entertainment. You know, their big thing is the Beat the Freeze. They have one of those really fast guys that gives somebody else a really large head start, and then ends up beating them more times than losing. But so what a lot of people don't know is that idea was based on, was it Lake Elsinore originally that had the squirrel, the fastest squirrel, Ace?
Yeah. Ace, the world's fastest squirrel. Oh, that exact same premise of, you know, kind of subverting, you know, because the mascot race has always been such a standard where a young child races the mascot and the mascot does everything in his power to lose and always does. And Lake Elsinore was kind of like, we're going to have a character who's a bit of a villain and who destroys the competition every night. And they had Ace, the fastest squirrel in the world, a guy in a squirrel costume who was a former track, you know, collegiate track athlete, and he would give everyone a head start and then destroy them.
Yeah.
And then the freeze came along in Atlanta. It went viral, and it was really well done. I'm not knocking it. But I always kind of felt like, I bet you guys got that idea from Lake Elsinore. There was no explicit acknowledge of it, but I was like, you know, us minor league folk know this has been done before. And that is the case. You know, in the major leagues, it's obviously a much more conservative environment.
Yeah.
Teams can't get away with as much as they get away with in the minors because a big portion of the fan base will take that tone of, you know, this is, you know, kind of beneath us to do this, you know, Bush League thing, to wear these crazy jerseys, to do this crazy theme night. But you do see ideas that have been successful in the minors trickle up to the major
especially
leagues.
Star Wars night is another one that is I've seen across Major League Baseball. Star Wars bobbleheads and all that stuff.
Absolutely, Star Wars nights, elements of Bark in the Park for sure.
Yeah. Purr in the Park, not quite yet.
Yeah, I don't think we'll ever see Purr in the Park on the major league level, but you never know. And there's no doubt that the minor leagues are, in addition to being a testing ground for the players, is some because you have a lot more freedom to do things. It's a testing ground for promotions that might, you know, work their way up to the majors for sure.
Yeah. So we talk about so much like the new things that we see in ballparks, and obviously one of the big things you go to ballpark for is for ballpark food. A lot of people might just go for the traditional hot dogs or the nachos, but at least, like, thanks to you, now when I go to ballparks, I need to find the most unique thing on the menu and order that and try it. So obviously that's a very big part of your Ben's Biz blog, is now you have designated eaters because you have unfortunately had been diagnosed with celiacs and can't eat some stuff. So can you talk a little bit about your designated eater program and kind of how it's grown since its installation?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, just no matter what I'm covering in the world of the minors, what I'm trying to do is to highlight something that's unique, you know, and or regional. So I always had that approach with the food. I got diagnosed with celiac disease in 2012, which is a story in and of itself. But the bottom line is, if you have celiac disease, you know, there's no cure per se. It's just you have to go gluten-free. And to be gluten-free, you can't eat wheat, rye, or barley. And a lot of ballpark food has gluten in it, you know, most commonly in, like, all buns and anything that's, like, breaded and deep-fried. So very quickly after this diagnosis, I was like, you know, I can't just not cover food because I can't eat a lot of it. And the idea of a designated eater came to me almost immediately. And the premise of that is just I recruit someone at the ballpark to consume the ballpark cuisine that my gluten-free diet prohibits. And so it started in 2012, late in the season. And, you know, like anything else, it kind of I've done it in different ways through the years. But, you know, the way I've done it the last couple of years is I'll announce my itinerary in, you know, late March usually and say, here's everywhere I'm going. And I need a designated eater at every place. And send me an email if you're interested. And, you know, some places I get a whole lot of submissions and others I get one or none at all.
Yeah.
And, you know, usually based on the market size in a lot of ways. And then that's been a really good part of my content. And just to not just cover the food, but to do it through the lens of, you know, usually a local fan and to be able to tell their story to some small degree as well.
Yeah. Was there any ballpark food specifically over the past like year or so like that was so unique that you remember?
You know, any question like that, my initial brain response is just this gigantic jumble, kind of like, oh man, where was I? So I'm trying to think last year. Right now I'm even having trouble remembering.
That's all right.
It'll all come to me. But, you know, especially like when you're going to like, say, new ballparks, you know, the Biloxi Shuckers had oysters, you know, that they served on Frisbees. And, you know, shucker is an oyster term. So, of course, they had oysters. You know, that kind of thing where you're focusing on something that's, you know, unique to the team. And then we've seen a whole new level of that over the last 3 years or so where teams are all doing these one night only or maybe recurring identities where they suit up, they change their team name, you know, for a regional food item.
Yeah.
Like I was in Trenton last year for the debut of the pork roll and, you know, got a lot of pork roll coverage. I was in Aberdeen last year for when they were the steamed crabs and, you know, had Crab Feast at the ballpark and gave away team logo crab mallets and that sort of thing. So
yeah, I thought it was cool. Lehigh Valley did the cheesesteaks and then they sent out all the merch in like cheesesteak wrapping.
That's yeah, right. And that's become a big part of it is how they sell the merch. You know, the Staten Island Pizza Rats last year selling the merch in pizza boxes with, you know, red pepper, you know, little packets of like Parmesan and red pepper.
Yeah.
You know, I think the Amarillo Sod Poodles this year selling their merchandise and like, you know, in what's supposed to look like a wooden crate.
Interesting.
You know, that would actually have a sod poodle in it, which is a prairie dog. You know, who knew? You learn so much through minor
league baseball. Yeah, sod poodles, trash pandas. There's a lot coming to minor league baseball in the next couple of years.
Absolutely.
So we're going to move right along to that, and that's the rebranding topic, how I'm kind of trying to start this whole reboot of the After Hours podcast, talking about rebranding since it's really, you know, boomed, really. You talked about a ballpark boom. There's probably been a rebranding boom as well over the last 5 or 6 years. Obviously, like the whole concept of it really started with teams starting in new cities and kind of having new names. I mean, the first one I remember, like towards when all of this started, was the El Paso Chihuahuas. That was like when the crazy, like zany names started. Obviously, there's the Iron Pigs too, and there's so many other names out there: Rumble Ponies, Rubber Ducks, Rail Riders, Woodpeckers. So this past off season, obviously, we've had a number of new names, new looks and everything. So I know you wrote a column on all of them for the most part, but we're just going to go down the list right now and kind of give me your thoughts on what you think of the look. Obviously, the refresh logos will probably have a little less than the new names completely, but we're just going to go down the list. How's that sound?
Hey, sure.
All right, so the first team that we'll talk about is the Round Rock Express. Quick logo refresh there.
Yeah, I mean, when I did my rebranding story that you mentioned, I've done that every year for the last couple of years, you know, recapping all the team names and new logos. I didn't even include the Express because to me it was more kind of a refresh. But they did change the primary logo, and I kind of belatedly added the story, but it was certainly one of the more subtle changes when it comes to teams who change their logo. I like the Tequila Sunrise alternate logo that they have that you know, ties them into the new affiliation with the Astros. And that's really what motivated the logo change for them, was that after they were with the Rangers, they're now with the Astros, and they just wanted to, you know, to refresh for that new relationship, which is, you know, not necessarily, it's definitely one of the biggest reasons teams change logos, is in the wake of affiliation change. And this year, you know, at the conclusion of a even numbered year is when those affiliation changes happen. So the Express changed their logo in conjunction with saying, announcing the new affiliate. So it all was kind of one big package, like,
right,
okay, we're an Astros affiliate and here's our new look. And bam, they did that as early in the process as you could do it, you know, September 20th or whatever it was.
Yeah. And of course, as you know, you always have to trust that process. I had to drop that in somewhere. Up next, the Nashville Sounds. Obviously the Nashville Sounds are more still like a recent team. You know, having really rebranded back in like early January 2015, and now less than 4 years later, they rebranded now to a more traditional look that doesn't necessarily go completely away from their music history. So what are your thoughts on their new look?
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned with the Express how affiliation changes are one of the biggest reasons for new logos. Another big reason is new ballparks. And when the Express changed their logo in 2015, or not the Express, the Sounds, Nashville changed their logo in 2015 with the new ballpark. So now that's just 4 years later, you wouldn't expect a whole nother, new set of logos. But I think they wanted to go back to really, I think in 2015 it was all about, we have a new ballpark and we're gonna have like a really new look. And just 4 years later, I think they wanted to be like, you know what, like we have a brand and something that's really specific to us that goes back decades. So we want to go in that direction. So I like the classic looks, and it's a more conservative look, but I like it. They've got the roundel, which you don't see very often.
Yeah.
You know, the circular primary logo. And it does look like a logo that could have existed, you know, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, whatever the case may be.
Yeah, definitely. The other team that just refreshed their logo was the Fresno Grizzlies. That was more recent, back in mid-January of 2019. So they had a combination of Brandiose, which is the big, you know, rebranding, redesign, logo company that's been sweeping the nation since the rebrand started. But they also use some in-house, work as well to help refresh that design. So, what can you tell us about that one?
Yeah, I mean, the Grizzlies have been, you know, really innovative with their own in-house graphic design for years. You know, they were the first team to change their name, you know, to a food item with the tacos, and, you know, set a trend with that, and they did that in-house. And, you know, I was kind of surprised they didn't do their whole logo in-house, just because that seems always to be their MO, but they did work with Brandiose. The overall logo is not a major departure from what they had before, but I think usually when you're talking about new looks and new logos, you're not really talking about the uniform first and foremost, but that was really kind of the lead with the Grizzlies. in that they have red pants. That's what got a lot of the attention. And you're going to have this team wearing red pants, which you really have to go back decades, at least in the major leagues, to find a team that was wearing red pants. And not too surprised. It's, you know, the Grizzlies have always been outside the box. So kind of not too surprising that they were like, you know, let's go for it.
Yeah, I feel like they were one of the first teams that I remember doing those We Hate the Off-Season videos. I mean, it started back in like 2009, 2010. They have really, they did We Hate the Off-Season videos, and I remember their mascot was a big part of those, and other teams started picking it up after that. But I do remember that they're one of the teams out west that do things so well in-house that when I first looked to see that they even used Brandiose for part of it, I was actually kind of surprised. But again, not a far departure from what they were previously. But yeah, that's kind of like the three new logo teams. We have six new names currently, you know, five of which will be suiting up for the 2019 season and another for the 2020 season. So the first one that we'll talk about is probably one of the more maybe not as exciting ones, the Syracuse Mets, a rebrand to be the Syracuse Mets from the Syracuse Chiefs, obviously celebrating their affiliation with the Mets.
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes without saying that is the least exciting name change of the 2018-2019 offseason. You know, the Syracuse, their team had only ever been the Chiefs dating back to the 30s. So one of the few kind of classic minor league markets that never at any point had the name of their parent club. And kind of interesting in the year 2019 when most teams are going for independent identities for Syracuse to take on the mantle of the parent club. But you know, the Mets own the team. So yeah. There's a whole nother thing at play there. And, you know, that's a real good move for Syracuse. It's been a community-owned team, which is a great arrangement and something to be nostalgic about. But, you know, it really solidifies the footing of the franchise with the Mets ownership. They've agreed to be in Syracuse for something like a lease extension of something like 26 years. So while it's a little disappointing for someone, you know, like me who likes to cover, you know, things that are new and unique and not just a parent club name, it is a very significant season for Syracuse and that they are now a Mets affiliate owned by the Mets. Putting aside last year, the very anomalous situation in which the Mets owned the team, but they were still a Nationals affiliate.
Yeah.
But that was just a little blip. But now that affiliation has expired, it's going to be Syracuse and the Mets, you know, hand in hand for decades now. And the name reflects that.
Yeah, and obviously it'll be interesting to see how they fare with regard to merchandise and all that stuff. Obviously being in New York, upstate New York will help because there's probably a good contingency of Mets fans there and everything. But I know, you know, having worked with the Gwinnett Braves, now the Gwinnett Stripers, you know, that's a team that was maybe a little close to the big league affiliate that might have, you know, suffered from having the same name as the parent club, and now they have a different name and have the ability to create their own identity. Now, obviously, the Mets, as you mentioned, you know, they signed a lease extension for 20 plus years. This is something, obviously, that they're going to stick with for a while, but do you think that, you know, having that Mets name perhaps in the long run might have it kind of mixed in the market with other things?
I think so, yeah. I understand why they did it for now because, well, one, the Mets call the shots, and two, it really does signify a very major change for the organization. But big picture, you know, I don't really know how much value long term there is in having that name, because, you know, Syracuse, I'm sure there are a lot of Mets fans, but I'm sure there's a lot of other fans of other markets who would probably proudly wear the gear of you know, of their Syracuse team if it was a unique identity. But if it's like, if you're a lifelong Yankees fan, even if you live
and you're going to school at Syracuse and want to catch a game, you know, what do you do?
Yeah. So if they had a unique identity, you might be like, ah, they're a Mets affiliate, but I don't care.
Yeah.
I'm proud because it's a Syracuse thing. When you just have the name Mets, then you're kind of like alienating people who just wouldn't ever wear Mets gear or whatever the case may be. You know, Major League fandom is much more kind of dyed in the wool and things that people aren't willing to overlook when it comes to their own choices. So down the line, I don't know. And I don't have any inside info on that. But I wouldn't be surprised as the years and even decades go on that maybe they'll go back to something unique. But for now, it's a bold new Mets era, and they're celebrating it.
Yeah, and I definitely speak from experience when it comes to, like you said, being a Yankees fan going to a Mets game. I remember working with the Braves, and that tomahawk chop was very hard to do every single time it played, knowing I'm that Phillies fan at heart. So definitely difficult when you have that name sometimes and fans that might be from different areas. Obviously, for employees, it doesn't really matter, but...
It doesn't. You just got to do your job. But I recall that when I visited Gwinnett when you were there, I remember you saying that.
Yeah.
Like, oh man, this is tough for me.
Really, you got to really dig deep down into your soul in order to do the tomahawk chop as a Phillies fan. And now when I go to the big league Braves games, it's just the worst. It's the worst kind of thing. But moving on to better things. One of the new teams that will be introduced to in 2019 are the Fayetteville Woodpeckers, replacing the Bowie Creek Astros. What can you tell us about the rebrand of the Woodpeckers? I know for me personally, this was one of the more traditional rebrands that I actually kind of enjoyed the logos. It wasn't too zany, but there's a lot of opportunity for growth.
Yeah, I mean, really... Baseball hasn't been in Fayetteville since the Cape Fear Crocs of decades ago. You know, when the team was in Bowie's Creek the last couple of years, that was only a temporary thing. It was on the campus of Campbell University. So, you know, they had plenty of time when they were playing in Bowie's Creek and building a new ballpark in Fayetteville to think of the name and, you know, run the name, the team contest and do whatever process you want to do. And that's kind of what I like about covering rebrands is like every team has a story. And, you know, the Woodpeckers, you know, Fayetteville is home to Fort Bragg and, you know, the world's largest military installation. But it's also home in Fort Bragg to one of the most robust population of the red cockade woodpecker. So it kind of speaks to both Fort Bragg and, you know, the fact that there are woodpeckers on Fort Bragg. Living within Fort Bragg, and you know, then teams always try to come up with larger justifications, like the woodpecker is strong and resilient, just like the people of Fayetteville. You know, I feel like every rebrand you learn that the people are strong and resilient and underdogs, and
unless the fans don't like it, which seems to be the case in a lot of rebrands. But I like how like you said, going into the history of the area being a large population of a specific type of woodpecker, it always makes the name make a little more sense when you have that tie-in like that. I remember Akron when they rebranded from the Arrows to the Rubber Ducks. Everybody thought it was like the silliest thing in the world, and then you find out that you know, they're the rubber capital of the world. And then, you know, like the Binghamton Rumble Ponies are a team that are the Rumble Ponies because they're like the carousel capital of the world. So it's things that you never know about these cities.
Yeah, it doesn't make it not silly, but there's always additional layers of justification that do speak to the town. And you're absolutely right that the fans don't like rebrands, especially in the early going, but they usually come around once they get a sense of the ballpark experience with the new branding. And it's just kind of a given in the industry that you take your lumps right away, you know, with these new names and, you know, like you said, trust the process.
Yeah.
Because this wouldn't, if this was a bad move, you know, you know, economically for the team, teams wouldn't do this just because it's fun to alienate their fan base. They do it because they know what they're doing big picture. And you keep seeing these rebrands because at the end of the day, they're mostly successful, largely successful. And that a lot of the negativity at the beginning is simply because the fans don't really, they just have had no precedent for 21st century minor league baseball. Once they experience it, then all of a sudden it's like, oh, actually, okay, like this. And you see that play out time and time again, you know, with almost all these teams, whether it's Akron or going back to Lehigh Valley, El Paso, you know, whatever the case may be.
Yeah, you embrace it after a while.
You absolutely.
the Amarillo Sod Poodles, which I think is up there with one of the zanier names of this off-season's rebrand or even past off-season rebrands.
That one got more attention than most in the branding process, both locally and nationally. It was, I don't want to say necessarily it was the favorite of the local community, but right from the time all the finalists were announced, it's the one that got the most attention. And, you know, a lot of it was like, what? You know, I've lived in Amarillo my whole life and I've never heard of a sod poodle before. But it did capture the imagination. And when I talked to Tony Enzer, the team president, you know, he was giving me all these examples that I went back and researched and found. But like, you know, a local minister using sod poodles in a sermon and a local bakery selling sod poodle cookies and, you know, local news segments where reporters are going around and asking people, what is a sod poodle? And that's publicity. And there's something about that name that really got in everyone's head. And of course, it wasn't always positive, but people really gravitate toward that name. And I like the logo because it shows multiple sod poodles. You know, usually whatever the team may be.
You don't want to unveil a logo of sod poodles with just one sod poodle. The fans want more sod poodles.
Yeah, you got multiple sod poodles, and it really did kind of take on a life of its own. There's a guy, I think his name's Carson Leverett, you know, who wrote a sod poodle song before it was even picked as the team name. And
wow.
I believe he's playing that at the ballpark on opening day. Really catchy song. You might want to look it up. So that's been an interesting one to see for sure.
Another one of the interesting ones. I mean, I think this one's my favorite logo of them all, is the rookie league team, the Rocky Mountain Vibes. And this logo, if you're listening and have not heard of the Rocky Mountain Vibes, their logo is more or less like a s'more. Very cool looking logo. And obviously with Colorado Springs relocating, like you mentioned, to San Antonio, so San Antonio can become that AAA club, but baseball stays in that area. Thanks to the Rocky Mountain Vibes, what are your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, like you mentioned, it's been a whole series of domino moves. From Helena moving to Colorado Springs, Colorado Springs moving to San Antonio, San Antonio moving to Amarillo. It's hard to keep track of. There won't be a test, but There might be. Colorado Springs have been a AAA market. They've been the Sky Sox. You know, even though it's Colorado, Colorado Springs is a pretty conservative town, military town. They'd always been a pretty conservative franchise when it came to how they marketed. But now that they're going down all the way from really, you can't make a bigger jump or move in terms of levels going from AAA all the way down to rookie ball. And I really like that the front office embraced it and are just like, all right, you know, we're a whole new entity now and we're going to do something totally different. And Vibes, that's such a unique name. It's not a thing. It's not an animal. I mean, it is a thing.
It's a feeling. It's an emotion. Feeling.
Yeah, and how many teams are named after emotions? And, you know, I don't know all the specifics, but it seems like for whatever – Happy Campers was one of the Name the Team finalists. And so I think they developed a lot of this identity around Happy Campers before then saying like, well, what is – you know, what makes these Happy Campers in Colorado? It's because of the vibes, man. It's because of those Rocky Mountain Vibes. So it went from Happy Campers to the Vibes. The Vibes was not even one of the Name the Team finalists, much like your former employer in Gwinnett, who did not have stripers among the finalists and went with that. So it caught, you know, it was a definitely caught everyone off guard. At their Name the Team unveiling contest, they faked everyone out.
Yeah.
And briefly acted like they were going to rename themselves the Rocky Mountain Oysters, which is a, you know, regional delicacy.
Yeah.
That is a polarizing one for sure. But they went with the Vibes, and the anthropomorphic s'more that is one of the logos and will be one of the new mascots. His name is Toasty. So you've got this, you know, you're feeling some toasty vibes in Colorado, man.
Yeah.
It's a fun one. It might be my favorite of the new ones. You know, again, like I cover the world and I don't editorialize too much, but I'm definitely a fan of the Vibes.
Yeah. So going on to the last one for the 2019 season, kind of a more traditional rebrand in a sense, the Las Vegas 51s. rebranding to be the Las Vegas Aviators. This was one of the rebrands that didn't actually use Brandios, instead used a different company. Their logo, at least from my thoughts, is just, a combination of a couple of things. It almost looks like an alien is under the aviator cap that they have there. What are your thoughts on this one?
Well, when I mentioned earlier that one of the motivators for new names or logos is a new stadium, and that's the case in Las Vegas. They're moving from Cashman Field to a new ballpark, just called Las Vegas Ballpark. But the thing with that is Las Vegas Ballpark is actually in adjacent Summerlin, Nevada, which is a planned community owned by the Howard Hughes Corporation. The Howard Hughes Corporation also owns the team. And the Aviators' name is a reference to Howard Hughes' aviation exploits. So you really can't talk about this logo without talking about the Howard Hughes Corporation, which owns the team, owns the town in which the ballpark is located,
right,
and has now an identity based around Howard Hughes himself. So it all ties into that. The logo kind of takes some getting used to. The aviator, he's got the aviator goggles on, but at first glance, it does look a little alien or kind of like a fly, like a big bug-eyed fly.
Yeah.
But then when you see the name, you're like, oh, he's an aviator. He's got the glasses. It's pretty striking. He's got the mountains reflected in his goggles, which reference the mountains, right around Vegas. I can't remember the range name off the top of my head. But again, like all these things, they speak to very specific things. And it's a good thing. It's a good way, if nothing else, to learn about the region in question.
Now, obviously, for 2020, we have Kannapolis planning to rebrand. We're going to get to see the new Wichita team that will be replacing the New Orleans Baby Cakes. But there is one team for 2020 that we do know what they are going to be called, and that is the Rocket City Trash Pandas. And again, they won't debut until 2020, but they will replace the Mobile Bay Bears in the AA Southern League. And obviously, this is the one of more unique rebrands there, with the logo being more or less a raccoon, which are trash pandas bursting out of a trash can. So your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I mean, I think the team, maybe with the timeline of the new ballpark, thought for a while they might have the ballpark ready for 2019, so they went way ahead in the branding process, and in case that the ballpark was ready for 2019, it won't be. So they have the unique scenario of already having an identity for a team that's not going to be around until 2020, while Mobile simultaneously plays out its last season in 2019. This is an interesting one. The team is going to play in Madison, Alabama, but basically representing the Huntsville area. And Huntsville is known as Rocket City because of their NASA and Department of Defense, the presence of those organizations in the area. So Rocket City is a reference to that. And somehow Trash Pandas became a thing. I know that Trash Pandas were referenced in Guardians of the Galaxy, so there's kind of a current pop culture tie-in. But it's also just a very striking name. They have done phenomenally well with just overall name recognition and, selling merchandise all over the country and all over the world. And what it is basically is a raccoon with the ingenuity of a Huntsville rocket scientist who is able to get to space just with, his own ingenuity, with anything he salvages from the garbage. And, that's one real smart raccoon who can just put together a spaceship and fly into outer space based on what he finds in the garbage.
Is there anything rare that you've ever salvaged from the garbage? Because I can't think of anything for me.
No, I'd love finding things. Living in New York City, I found plenty of things on the streets, but most of the only things I keep are books.
Yeah.
I haven't found anything valuable, and I have not been able to assemble a working spacecraft.
Well, we've gone through all the rebrands for the 2019-2020 seasons. Obviously, we're going to have to wait and see what Kannapolis and Wichita does. But Ben, do appreciate you taking some time to chat about your minor league journey and kind of help kick me off on this new rebranded After Hours podcast, which we'll be diving a little deeper into the rebrand, speaking to some of the teams themselves that went through the logo change and logo refreshers.
Yeah, my pleasure to talk about it. This is the world in which I reside, so I've got too much of this information.
Yeah, I had to exploit you for that, so I appreciate you coming on, and hopefully we'll be able to catch up with you on another episode.
All right, be my pleasure.